This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Podcast source for discussion of genre films from the VHS era and sometimes a little beyond. You remember the days when you would scour your mom and pop video store on a Friday or Saturday night looking for something in the action, horror, or sci-fi realm? Well, we remember, and that's part of the fun here at Go Home in a Box. We remember movies like Steel and Lace, where rape victims kill themselves and come back 5 years later as revenge-seeking cyborgs. We never said anything about the movies being in good taste, folks. I'm one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. And you can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week I review Walter Hill's 1979 cult classic, The Warriors. You know it, you quote it often, and I dissect it at RetroMovieNerd. I'll also be adding a new feature where I highlight a trio of films that can be found streaming on Amazon's Prime Video service. You remember the time when Netflix had almost any movie you could think of? You remember that time, Joel?
I do. I missed that time very acutely.
Yeah, well, they don't care about cinephiles anymore, so I don't care about Netflix anymore. I've canceled my subscription, and I subscribe to Amazon's Prime Video. And they've got plenty of interesting choices, and I just want to highlight some of the movies I've been watching at Retro Movie Nerd every week, so that'll be a new feature to watch out for. So check it out.
You canceled your Netflix? I mean, you're missing that new that Americanized Death Note, dude.
Look, well, there's a very good reason why I canceled, Joel. Hey, I mean, I can't find a single horror film other than Jaws. I can't find a single movie from the 70s that I haven't seen. It's a shame what's become of Netflix. It's really just a streaming on-demand TV network now. Everything's binge-watching episodic television, so I no longer have any interest in keeping it around. And if you're a cinephile like we are, there's other services out there for us. You know, we've mentioned Shudder many times on the show. But I also want to make note that, give a heads up that Amazon has a pretty decent, streaming video service. You know, if you subscribe to their two-day shipping, it's like $10.99 a month, you get their streaming video service as a bonus. And there's quite a few interesting, there's many, hundreds of interesting movies on there. From martial arts films from the 70s to early 90s Z-grade cop thrillers. It's quite an interesting cache of movies I have there as Amazon. So I'll give a rundown on a few of those every week. So it's quite cool. And of course, he's already speaking up. Joining me as always is the half man, half machine hybrid yoga instructor. It's the Ayatollah of pop culture, Joel La Puma.
I prefer to think of myself as half man, half amazing. But you can find me online at RazorCandy at razor-candy.com. We probably won't have anything new for a couple weeks. Roxy's co-writer Roxy is working on a larger writing project elsewhere. But after that, we'll be back with some new articles.
Awesome. Yeah, your piece on the paperback covers, that was quite awesome. I did enjoy that.
I appreciate that. We'll probably have a new one of the. We've still got a number of horror paperback covers we didn't make fun of in that installment. So that'll probably be our next piece going over some of the ones we didn't get to yet.
Yeah, excellent stuff, Joel. I appreciate that. Big fan of the site. So keep the good work, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. All right, so we've got a plethora of topics to cover this week, And we're going to always kick off, as always, with our new releases, our new retro releases. You know, these are just for the uninformed. You know, these are older films that are getting the re-release treatment, whether it's an immediate cash grab by some distributor or it's a long-awaited, much-requested film. In a few cases, that's what we got here this week, finally making the shelves on Blu-ray. We'll start it off with a couple of releases from Synapse. The first one we want to mention from 1985 is Dario Argento's Phenomena, starring Jennifer Connelly as a girl who somehow seems to have some kind of control over insects. Isn't that right, Joel?
That's correct. And she is working to solve a series of murders with Donald Pleasance, who, if I recall, it's been a while since I've seen this, but he's a doctor that that uses insects to determine date of death.
Oh, wow,
like,
yeah.
Like a forensics expert. There's a lot of bizarre stuff in this. I mean, most people would put it in like top five Argento, and I definitely agree. I mean, there's a chimpanzee wielding a razor. Jennifer Connelly, you know, has some insect kinesis. I don't know what the actual word for it would be. And the whole thing inspired a video game series somehow.
Wow, okay. That part I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, the Clock Tower series. It's a point-and-click survival horror series that started on the Super Famicom, the Japanese Super Nintendo. The original one never made it to America, but you can find you can find a translated ROM pretty easily. It's a really great series of games, and it's very clear that in the first two, the protagonist is very clearly modeled after Jennifer Connelly in this movie.
All right, very cool. That's why you're the Ayatollah of pop culture, Joel.
Because I wasted my younger years playing translated ROMs of Japanese Super Nintendo games.
And also the fact that you dig deep for a lot of your discussion points. You are a walking encyclopedia of movie and meaningless trivia. Yeah. So Phenomena, out on Blu-ray from Synapse. Also from Synapse, we've got a double movie pack here. Quite an interesting one at that. We've got a film from 2014 called The Creep Behind the Camera. And that's combined with the 1950s horror film, The Creeping Terror. And I believe The Creep Behind the... Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Early 60s, 64. And it,
yeah, that's right, 1964. I was thinking of one of our other movies.
It was riffed on Mystery Science Theater 3000. It's considered one of the worst films of all time. Extremely low budget. I don't remember the exact figure, but it's something. But it's, you know, something like under $10,000, I think.
Wow, that is very cheaply made.
I might be wrong on that. I'd have to actually double check, but it was an extremely low budget film.
Now I wonder if the catering behind the scenes for that film was just like hot dogs.
I think the catering was whatever you could steal from a Safeway dumpster.
Yeah, so you know, hey, you know, at least it doesn't come out of the budget then.
I guess the director and star of The Creeping, extremely terrible human being, a complete wreck. You know, he died of liver failure when he was 41. He was He was repeatedly sued, charged with fraud. He vanished like right before the film was released. So The Creep Behind the Camera is the story of that. I know his wife wrote a novel about like her life with him. I think it's probably heavily based off that.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting story. I think that's an interesting combo pack to pick up then, if that's the case. You know, if you're into, like, biopics of some of Hollywood's lesser-known, maybe even seedier characters.
Yeah.
This seems like a quite an interesting combo.
Yeah, if you're into the seedier side of Hollywood, this is like a great opportunity if you've, you know, worn out your copy of Ed Wood. I know the special features have a some kind of interview with Frank Conniff, TV's Frank from Mystery Science Theater. So it would seem to have the MST seal of approval to this whole venture.
Yeah, so probably one of the more interesting reels this week, then, Joel.
Yeah, Synapse always like comes up with really strange, cool, weird things. So this definitely seems worth looking into.
Okay. Well, another one on the list. This isn't one I'm not familiar with. It's from VCI, also on Blu-ray from 1977. It's a film called Ruby. And I haven't seen this one, Joel, and so I don't have much to go on with this one.
Yeah, I'm not terribly familiar with this one myself. Let me see. Piper Laurie starring in it. Curtis Harrington from who directed Night Tide directed it. Actually, this is one I'm probably gonna have to pick up because this is kind of a fascinatingly weird thing. Piper Laurie's daughter is a deaf mute who runs a drive-in theater. The spirit of her dead husband is possessing her daughter. He was a mobster who got executed. Like, this seems like a weird sort of post-Exorcist, post-Carrie film. I mean, just for Piper Laurie and Curtis Harrington, would check this out. It seems extremely strange. I guess for a while, the only available copy was a re-edited television cut of it. So this seems to be the full cut. VCI did put out a DVD of this over 15 years ago. This would seem to be the upgrade for that. So this is extremely weird little curio, and I'm really excited to see it just for the people involved.
Yeah, in the late 70s, so it's still got that weird, strange, 70s drive-in feel to it, I'm sure. And it's just based on how you're explaining it, it just seems like one of those movies where they threw a lot of shit at the wall to see what stuck. And I mean, this it seems like it might be memorable just in how nutty it might be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not expecting something on the level of Night Tide, which is like, you know, one of the all-time great creepy understated horror films, but Harrington did a lot of other cool movies. I mean, he did What's the Matter with Helen, which a lot of our listeners might have seen on the Scream Factory releases of that. You know, he did a lot of TV horror in the 70s. Interesting director who with a varied career full of weird stuff that probably only really got to express his full vision about once with Night Tide, and other films are not ever going to be at that level, but you know, really interesting career.
Yeah. Well, speaking of interesting, we have another Arrow video released this week. They're always putting out interesting ones, and this is one we probably mentioned on the show before, but from 1972, it's Don't Torture a Duckling.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm not a huge Giallo fan, but, you know, it's hard to go wrong with this one. I mean, Arrow's releases are always extremely nice. I mean, just the cover art to this one is absolutely gorgeous. You know, I think Fulci's more insane films are more are better than giallos, but Don't Torture a Duckling is probably at the height of his ability with giallos.
Yeah,
it's a lot of people consider it his greatest film, and I totally understand, because there's a lot of great atmosphere. Like, there's a real anger to it. Like, his films are often just surreal and dreamlike, and this is it's very brutal. Like, it's very cynical about the Catholic Church. Like, there's a lot of really dark films, even for a giallo. Very dark themes, even for a giallo film. It's about child murder, it's about pedophilia, it's and probably one I'm going to have to revisit, because it's Fulci really, revealing himself more than he does in a lot of other films.
Yeah, and just on a side note, a lot of these early 70s giallos have, some of the best titles. And Don't Torture a Duckling is up there with them. I mean, there are probably some people who would avoid it based on the title itself if they took it literally. Definitely one of the things about the giallos is the cool and, interesting titles.
The only thing it's missing is a random number in the title.
Yeah. We have another interesting release as well here, Joel. I think this is a Latvian film or Russian, whatever the case is. I can't discern one from the other, but from the early 90s. It's called Spider.
Yeah, this seems like it is a Latvian shot and Russian language. I think it's sort of it's a rare film. It's like the first U.S. release of this. I think it's sort of notable for produced near the tail end of the Soviet Union in the Glasnost era, where filmmakers were free to do creepy, more explicit, stranger films again, at least do that kind of thing openly. So it seems to be sort of a very weird, psychosexual drama. I think if you're a fan of something like Possession, this seems like a good companion piece.
Yeah, and this is another one where, if you're into checking out, little known foreign films, I mean. This isn't something that was nominated for Best Foreign Film at the Academy Awards or anything like that, and it's definitely got curious, subject matter to it, and so it's probably one of those things that if you're looking to expand your horizons, this is probably one that you'd probably need to check out.
It looks curious. I mean, I like following that these kind of weird art house horror mashup films and just seeing where they go. I mean, I doubt this is going to be as absolutely hilarious as Possession ended up being, but it seems like a curious and possibly horrendously offensive little film. So
horrendously offensive, I'm there. Sign me up.
That's our wheelhouse.
And here we probably have another cash-in coming up here, Joel, from Lionsgate, the Blu-ray of, it's a combo pack, Evil Dead 1 and 2. I'm pretty sure this has been done many times.
I mean, at this point, are there people who don't own the Evil Dead films? I think they just give them away at, Olive Garden.
Did they give stuff away at Olive Garden?
I don't know, I don't think into an Olive Garden. I just assume they get people in the door through means that.
I think they put a microwave at every table, because that's basically what they're giving.
Yeah, free breadsticks, free salad, free Evil Dead. Whatever.
Sure thing. So yeah. So I mean, nothing wrong with Evil Dead 1 and 2 and Army of Darkness for all that matter. But I mean, come on, it's a combo pack. These movies have been out since the 80s, and they've been on various other packs in some form or another, and you know, it's just a Lionsgate cash grab. So chalk it up to that.
It's and, probably a Halloween season kind of thing for the for teenagers just discovering the Evil Dead films, and we were all that age once and first discovering Evil Dead. Here's your cheap release of Evil Dead 1 and 2, so for your collection.
Yeah. I'm surprised that we don't have a Evil Dead 1 and 2 Army of Darkness Ash versus the Evil Dead huge mega pack. You know what? We might actually have that. I'm not going to look it up. I'm just going to assume that somebody's thought of the idea to put Ash versus the Evil Dead with Army of Darkness and Evil Dead 1 and 2 in one great big box.
I'll never forget the day I walked into Walmart near Halloween and they and saw Evil Dead 2 on Blu-ray there for $7.50. And I thought, you could not get, Evil Dead could not get more well-known than this.
That's right. It used to be, you know, everyone's little secret guilty pleasure, but now it's a well-known film now, and it's lost its luster probably because of that, but still fine films. It's just not as special as it used to be to you personally.
It's true. I can remember when I had to make a real effort to seek out Evil Dead, and yeah, there was something kind of special about that. I mean, I'm glad it's accessible to everyone now. It's just now we've all seen these films so many times.
Yeah. Well, one that we probably haven't seen a whole lot of, we'll get to a Kino release here. Kino Classics, putting out from 1954, a little-known sci-fi film called Tobor the Great.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting release. I have not seen this one yet, but there's a really interesting pedigree to this film. The director, Lee Sholem, directed a lot of adventure serials, including a few Tarzan ones. He directed episodes of Adventures of Superman. He directed the Superman the Mole Men serial. So some cool stuff there. The cinematographer is actually probably much more famous. John L. Russell, who was the cinematographer for Psycho.
Yeah. Awesome.
Among other films. Orson Welles called him the greatest cinematographer in Hollywood history.
Nate Lyon, he ain't lying. Psycho is a quite memorable film because of the camera.
Oh, my God, yeah. And the designer of the robot in this film went on to design Robbie the Robot and the robot from Lost in Space. So, and when you look at the robot here, you can definitely see echoes of those two later designs already. Yeah. I mean, it looks just like a really cool, fun 50s sci-fi film. And one I'm surprised hasn't gotten, based on the people involved, hasn't gotten a bit more attention than it has.
Right, and like I saw the cover for this, and the first thing I thought of was Robbie the Robot. There was just, you could see it in the artwork on the DVD cover. So, and this is and like you said, this is probably one that probably needs a little light shed on it. And so, if you're into, 50s, 60s sci-fi, Tobor the Great is probably one that you need to pick up. Kino does some they have some great releases in the past, and this is probably no exception.
Yeah, I love Kino. It is nice to see them doing something a little off the beaten path for them like this. I mean, they're usually pretty pretty adventurous in what they release, but back on doing a lot of like classic westerns and classic Hollywood, so seeing them do something a little more out there is always nice.
Yeah, definitely. And then we have we got another DVD release here to get to Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy, you know, the Universal horror comedy classic.
Yeah, this is part of a spate of Mummy releases. They're releasing the Mummy film that shall not be named this week, in addition to some of the older ones, all the Brendan Fraser ones. This is, which I actually enjoyed the first one of those.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, I mean, if you're a fan of old Universal Monsters stuff, a fan of Abbott and Costello, I mean, these films probably don't need an introduction. They're just, like, ridiculous fun.
Yeah, they are. This is one that has been on one of my favorite horror hosted shows, Sven Gulli, many times. I'm not a huge Abbott and Costello fan, but he's played this movie on his show several times. And, you know, I hate to admit it, but I tune out when that happens. But that doesn't go beyond you, Joel. Don't tell me.
And this is why I'm getting a new co-host.
Oh, darn it. But I mean, Abbott and Costello, of course, a great comedy team. They have their fans, and this was the Universal's attempt to combine the comedy of Abbott and Costello with their franchises. There were many others, like Abbott and Costello Meet the Wolfman, and you know, they were fun for people back in the day, and so this is probably something you might want to pick up your grandpa or something.
Or Joel. Buy it for Joel.
Oh, Joel, yeah. And then we want to make mention here, these are not released just, but we are excited to talk about these real quick because our good friends at Shout Factory / Scream Factory, they're one and the same, but, you know, the Scream Factory tends to, you know, they lean more towards the horror side of things, but they're finally getting a Blu-ray release together for the 1981 forgotten classic Hell Night.
Oh, I'm really excited about the about this one. This was, they just announced it. It was a big surprise for a lot of people. I think it had been the news had been leaked a little bit before, but they couldn't announce it, and they couldn't announce it yet. But the rights for Hell Night have been so tangled up for a long while. I mean, the last official release, official DVD release, was by Anchor Bay years and years ago. I think they had a, you know, some kind of DVD-R on demand release through Amazon for a while. I'm not sure if that's still available. But, yeah, on December 12th, they will have, Hell Night is finally being released. It's a great, creepy, energetic, early 80s slasher film with a touch of, Hammer, kind of like Haunted House motif around it.
Yeah, with also a touch of Linda Blair.
Linda Blair, who was nominated for a Razzie for this performance, which I thought was a little unfair. I don't think she's really bad in it. but it's, you know, extremely fun. You know, great. Like, it's a shame it's coming out in December because it's a great Halloween feature to watch, but you know, the fact that we're getting it is pretty stunning. People have been waiting a very long time for this, and no one expected it to ever happen at this point, and it finally is.
Yeah, and it's great stuff. And speaking of which, you're talking about it's going to be released just in time for Christmas. But what about another future release? And this one comes with a little added bonus when you pre-order. We're talking Silent Night, Deadly Night, also being released on Blu-ray within the next few months.
And, you know, we've had Blu-rays of it from Anchor Bay before, but this is a 4K restoration by Scream Factory, and if you pre-order the Deluxe Limited Edition, which is a little expensive, it's like $65 off this exclusively on the Scream website, you not only get a full-size 18x24 poster of, I believe it's, forget who did the art on this one. I think it was Justin Osborne, who also did the Hell Night art for the new DVD. But you'll get an 8-inch action figure by NECA Toys of Billy Chapman in full killer Santa Claus garb with a bloody axe.
Yes. this is probably a must-have item for a lot of geeks out there.
And I'm sorry, the art on the poster, this is Joel Robinson's work. Not Justin Osborne is doing Hell Night, though. The figure is a Mego-style figure, you know, basic body with cloth clothes. You know, this is limited to 2000, which is why we're bringing this up because the pre-order is live, and I don't know how long it's going to last.
I mean, if you're giving away that figurine, then I expect them to crash the website.
I'm really enjoying Shout Factory's been partnering with NECA Toys on a number of releases. When they did the limited edition of the Bill and Ted collection from last year, they had a exclusive Rufus figure in the style with the pre-order. So I'm hoping they'll do more of these with their horror movies. I would love to see them re-release Sleepaway Camp with an Angela figure.
Oh, yeah. And not many people can claim that they have a George Carlin action figure.
I do have some of the old Bill and Ted figures from the 90s, luckily. I don't have the NECA Rufus from that release, unfortunately.
So, yeah. That's all great stuff. I mean, these distributors, some of them actually work very hard and lovingly on the stuff that they put out. And
Do you hear that, Netflix? Some people make an effort.
That's right. That's right, Netflix. Shut the fuck up and listen. there are people at companies and distributors that actually care about movies and they know who their audience is, and you know, they kind of whet people's appetites with a lot of these bonus items, like, you know, the figurines and things like that, and posters. And so it's kind of neat to see, you know, companies actually catering to their fan base for once, which is not something that can be said for other companies. But you want to keep your eye open for these because they're quite special.
Yeah, so. And Scream Factory's Shout Factory, Scream Factory, they're in a bit of a privileged position where they have the resources to do things like this. Put in those kind of bonuses, a lot of distribution companies work extremely hard on their releases, on restoration, on putting together really nice bonus material. But you know, it's nice to see a company getting to the level where they can provide those kind of extra merchandise, promotional items. I mean, it's not something that like most distributors would have the resources to do anymore.
Right. And we'll plug stuff like this whenever it comes along and keep you abreast of everything that is out there. That's what we do here, and we're glad to bring it to you. Well, Joel, moving on. We've got a topic to discuss, and this is a good one this week. This is another list. Everyone loves lists. Woo. Joel loves lists. I love lists. Everybody loves good lists.
The internet loves lists.
Yeah, the internet's full of lists, and this is no exception. This week, we're talking our favorite sci-fi fantasy villains. Now, the villain is always much more interesting than the hero of the story, in most cases. And in these cases, they definitely are. And we want to take some time out and give some love to our favorites in the genre. And, you know, this genre includes science fiction, your action sci-fi, maybe your horror sci-fi, whatever cases, and then your fantasy. We've got some sword and sorcery villains in here, and maybe one or two animated villains as well. So, I mean, we got some good stuff for you to get to. And what's your take on some villains in the sci-fi fantasy genre here, Joel?
You know, it's hard to do a really interesting sci-fi or fantasy villain. I mean, so many of them default to certain types. So, like, I mean, you know, fantasy villains, like a lot of sword and sorcery villains, it's always like generic evil sorcerer, generic like evil warlord. I'm always interested when there's a villain that goes beyond that, either through just an interesting concept for the villain, or just so much personality and so much detail to who they are and what they've built around them that it transcends, like, any tropes they might be using.
Yeah, well put, well said, and I tend to agree. And the fact that some villains in these type of movies can actually fall into, you can pigeonhole them, you can actually predict, you know, what's going to happen in a film based on who the villain is, so what we tried to pin down here with this list is just the villains that stand out to us that, you know, something about them is a little different than your average villain in the movies, and generally they are given, it's the person behind the character as well. You know, we've considered the actor playing the role, and that plays quite heavily into a lot of my picks. And I don't know about you, Joel, but how do you feel about the actor actually behind the role?
Oh, I mean, that's a huge part of it. I mean, you know, it's not the benefit of film is that the characters aren't just the characters as written; they're whatever the actor has brought to the performance. I mean, looking at your list, and sorry to disappoint our audience, but we have seen each other's lists already. This is not a surprise to us. I already see like one performance on yours that I know had elements of improvisation to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot, especially I think in sci-fi and fantasy and horror tends to be more villain centric. It's assumed in a horror movie the villain is going to be more interesting than the hero, because sci-fi and fantasy movies are often about like a hero's journey or a quest, like the villain is typically more of just an obstacle.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit more than just, and you know that the villain actually, in some cases here, actually ties into the hero's past in some cases. And so when you say more than just an obstacle, it's a personal battle as well between the hero and the villain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's also something I think in sci-fi, like, it's sort of almost forgotten how to do that properly because Star Wars is so intensely influential that it usually becomes like an obvious trope. Like, all right, this person is my long lost relative, or maybe they'll do a Princess Bride. Like, this person killed my long lost relative.
Right.
Like, but there are ways to do, and there are interesting ways to tie in the backgrounds of heroes and villains without going immediately to that well.
Right, and just FYI, I do not have Darth Vader anywhere near my list because that dude redeemed himself at the end of the story arc, and so we're not going for redemption here. We're just going for hardcore, badass motherfucker yeah. villains who just have complete black hearts.
Chris is a little more hardline about that than I am, I will say, but we're going here for our personal favorite. If you were to make a list of like best sci-fi villains, like everyone's gonna put Vader on there. Like everyone's.
Oh well, yeah, definitely. But that's the reason why I left Vader yeah. off mine though, because I really want it more obviously pure evil. I mean, with Vader. With the redemption at the end, obviously there was, you know, still something human left in him after
all. It's like one of those things where what more could we possibly say about Darth Vader? I honestly, at this point, like, I can already hear, like, millions of people throwing down their iPhones in fury. I am actually way more interested in Kylo Ren.
Oh,
because,
okay.
Like, because that need he's got to, like, equal up to this legend that he's in his mind, that he's basically an angry young man trying to make himself a great figure before he's ready to be, is a really interesting like take on a sci-fi, especially a Star Wars villain to me. It doesn't feel like a Star Wars villain I've seen before, which I really like.
Well, that may be something we'll revisit on a future show here after The Last Jedi gets released.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how his arc plays out. And he's not on my list, but you know, shout out, because I think it's a really phenomenal performance. And I think people gave not everyone, I think a lot of people seem to really appreciate that performance, but a lot of people gave M. Driver too much criticism for not being Darth Vader when that's kind of the point. And that really bothered me.
Exactly. So let's get to it. Let's get to our list here. We're going to give five. We'll do it in alternating turns, and I'll kick it off, and then Joel will provide his. I'm going to start with, of course, at the top of the list, or the bottom, depending on how you look at it. Number five is the top of my list, and I'm gonna go with from RoboCop, Clarence Boddicker, as played by Kurtwood Smith. Now, Kurtwood Smith owned this role. He made Clarence Boddicker one of the more sadistic sons of bitches on film. The guy just did not have any goodness in him whatsoever. No redemption for Clarence Boddicker. I mean, here's a guy who gleefully shot up Peter Weller in Cold Blood, just severing limbs and, you know, just cold-blooded murdering a cop. And add to the fact that, you know, poor old Miguel Ferrer, you know, leaving a grenade in his apartment. The guy creamed his own henchman when the guy turned into the Toxic Avenger there. just a heartless son of a bitch all around. Kurtwood Smith, Clarence Boddicker, you made my list at number five.
Oh, and he's one of my favorites from any action film, a sci-fi film. You know, because he manages to both sort of contravene what you'd assume a villain in that position would look like, and also runs contrary to another, like, overused trope. In a lot of crime fiction, a lot of film noir, there's, like, sort of an overused trope of this master assassin is really this, like, nerdy-looking guy.
Yeah.
And it's so overused at this point, and, like, it's just, you know, it's an obviously attractive, like, fictional trope for someone writing crime fiction. Like, this guy's not a heavy, he's like a short, balding guy with glasses. Kurtwood Smith, like, sort of fits that. I don't think he's short, but, like, you know, bald guy with glasses, he looks like he could be, like working for OCP. Like, he fixed that general outline, but at the same time, like, those in crime fiction, those, like, nerdy assassins are always very, like, quiet, or they seem really passive or meek. There's nothing meek about Kurtwood Smith in this. Like, you immediately understand why he heads an oddly multicultural gang. Like, because this guy has so much willpower and obviously absolutely no scruples. Like, he knows exactly how to make chaos fun, and he knows how to weasel out of things if need be. He knows how to like really go full force at someone. Like, he's just like an absolutely perfect, like, street gang leader, and he still looks like Kurtwood Smith.
Yeah, he was awesome. And FYI, I was in a fantasy baseball league last year, and I named my team "I Work for Dick Jones." Yeah. And that's a quote. That's a quote that I use often amongst friends, and my brother and myself always quoting RoboCop. But that's one of our favorite quotes, is "I work for Dick Jones," and we would scream it like he would. And Yeah, so, yeah. And Kurtwood Smith, actually, give him credit, I mean, because if you're familiar with the movie Fortress with Christopher Lambert, I mean, he was quite good in that as well. And, of course, his tour de force, of course, is Red Foreman in that 70s show, because he was always awesome in that.
If I've learned from anything from that 70s show and Dead Poets Society is that if you want a stern father to bully a meek son, like Kurtwood Smith is like the ideal of that guy.
He doesn't look like you. He does not look the way you have known him to act. He's the exact opposite. You don't fuck with Kurtwood Smith.
Yeah, he looks like he'd be like just a normal all-American dad, and he's just such an asshole. It's so wonderful. And a bit of a note on his awesome glasses in Helsbottiker. Apparently, Paul Verhoeven chose them because he wanted him to look like Heinrich Himmler.
Oh, yes. Awesome. Paul Verhoeven would do that.
That's the kind of brilliance that goes into RoboCop.
Yeah. So, yeah. Again, number five on my list, Kurtwood Smith as Clarence Boddicker in RoboCop.
And number five on my list, Chris, I'm going to have to throw you for a loop, unfortunately. I was originally going to go with Burmathrax, the awesome dragon from Dragon Slayer.
Oh, yeah.
As awesome as Burmathrax is, I think a lot of the more interesting elements of the film, it's a brilliant special effects creation. I mean, absolutely stunning. But I think a lot of the really interesting villainy in the film comes from the decision of the nearby community to basically impose a lottery on its young woman and sacrifice one every so often to Burmathrax. It's a real, like, yeah. What the figure of this dragon inspires is almost more interesting than the fact that there's this dragon burning things up. So I'm going to, but, you know, shout out, because Dragon's Lair is still one of my absolute favorite, like, fantasy movies. It's astounding. So instead, I think I'm going to go with full spoiler alert for one of my all-time favorite movies, The Hidden. I'm going with our shape-shifting alien villain from The Hidden.
Ah, that's an awesome movie, dude. That's a good choice.
Oh, I love that movie. And one of the things that really interests me about that movie, aside from, you know, the awesome character development, I mean, Kyle MacLachlan's amazing performance, with the body-jumping alien that creates impossible havoc with every new body. One of the things I really love is that it sort of subverts your expectations of like a pod person film, because like every film of that nature, something like whether, you know, it's alien sourced or mythically sourced, whatever, whether it's, you know, invasion of the Body Snatchers or Children of the Stones or just anything where the community surrounding you is turning strange, like there's always it's always subtle, it's always slow building, it's always a gradual conspiracy that seeks to like create this possibly growing, thriving hive mind, which is a great narrative, but it's been done so many times that I think everyone's expecting like the tropes that go along with it, all those story beats. What interests me with The Hidden is that its alien is just a pleasure seeker. I mean, with a normal human character, that wouldn't be as interesting. It's like if you took Boddicker from RoboCop and like took away like his like ability to lead people, took away his ability to deal with both you know, low-life scumbag and with, like, white-collar executives. Like, it'd just be, like, him creating havoc on the streets. Here it's interesting because this is a, like, pure id creature that knows it can't die easily. So it's using that to just, like, impulsively grab at everything nearby that, like, even interests it for a second. Like, yeah, whether it's, you know, going into a music store, stealing cassettes, stealing a boombox, shooting the guy behind the counter, like, you know, walking onto a Ferrari lot, stealing.
Oh, yeah. That's the scene I was going to hit on, was the opening scene where he steals the car and just, you know, proceeds to conduct a high-speed chase, yeah, throughout LA.
Yeah, robbing banks to the point where he, you know, he jumps into the body of a president, of a major senator or governor who is a prospective presidential candidate, and just says, "I want to be president," like, to a crowd. Like, he has no idea what this possibly entails, but he knows it's something people want, so he wants it too. It's just, you know, we've talked about before, is sort of a proto Grand Theft Auto, where this guy's living in a sandbox where he can create all the most interesting chaos you can think of. But, like, there's an inherent, like, criticism of consumerism and capitalism here without being as, like, overwhelmingly obvious, and that's not a bad thing, but without being as obvious as something like They Live, like, where it's just taking a person who has no scruples and no defenses against, you know, all the basic temptations of modern life we take for granted, whether it's alcohol, nice cars, sex, like, you know, anything, like advertising, food, you know, unhealthy food, shiny new appliances, whatever. It was, all the things we're barraged by day in, day out, like on our fancy Google watches that no one bought. You know, or Apple Watches, I should say, Google Glass that really no one bought. it, like, we're just so assaulted with these, you know, compulsions to buy, and, you know, They lived it that brilliantly, of course, too. But, you know, I think they attributed it to conspiracy, which is a cool way to do, like, a pod person plot. Yeah. Like, it's one where the pod people already won, basically, and you're fighting out from underneath that. But the hidden, so, you know, the idea that it's a conspiracy suggests that it's not necessarily in our nature, and it's, and without trying to be too cynical, like, that acquisitive lust, of course it's, yeah, in people. I mean, even the best people, like, it's something to suppress. So showing the logical outcome of someone with that lust for acquisition, but no scruples and no need to not even a physical survival need to restrain themselves, is just an awesome way to create a chaotic villain.
Yeah. And of course, if this movie was to be made today, our villain would be posting selfies all over Facebook.
Oh my God, posting a selfie in front of, like, the car he crashed at the at the police roadblock. That would actually be awesome.
That's what strikes me about this, is that, you know, he's enjoying, you know, committing the acts that he's doing. So the only thing missing is bragging about them, and I think in this day and age, someone like that would probably do something like that. Just take a picture of the Ferrari you just stole, of you inside the Ferrari you just stole, and just post it all over Facebook.
Yeah, that kind of need for recognition. We even see that a little bit. In the film itself, when of course there's the "I want to be president" scene, but even at the opening, when it's the security camera footage from inside the bank he's going to rob, and he sort of smiles up at the camera, like he's aware that he's being watched and he's enjoying that.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely another dimension there to add to your villain. There is the need for attention, I guess. Well, I guess what I'll do is move on to my number four then, Joel. And this one's from an earlier Australian film. We all know what this film is. From 1979. We're talking Mad Max. And we're talking Toe Cutter. As played by Mr. Hugh Keysburn. Basically, this guy is a toe cutter's a combination of cruel and crazy, and he's not very calculating, but he's just definitely just, I guess, reactionary to a lot of things. He's just in the now. He's just the world's nearing the end, and there's lawlessness everywhere, and Toe Cutter is just leading a pack of motorcycle gang, and you know, one thing about him is that we see the cruelty of him when he's rejected by Max Rockatansky's wife, and he basically runs her down in the street while she's holding her child in her arms trying to run away. He just takes his motorcycle and runs him down. I mean, if that's not the ultimate in cruelty and insanity and just cold-bloodedness, I don't know what is. Hugh Keysburn plays this thing to the hilt. He's kind of weird. There's a weird vibe around him. Like, his reaction to when the lady comes out of her house with a shotgun and how he says he hates guns. It's just the whole way he says it. He's kind of like flinching back a little bit, you know, cowering a little bit, and he says, "I hate guns."
He's got
He's got a weird vibe to him, but I mean, underneath it, he's just there's just no hope for this character. Just like there's no hope for the world that he lives in, and he's just playing, you know. Keysburn is playing it to the hilt, and you know, this is one of the more memorable characters in film.
Yeah, Toe Cutter's got a very like sexualized swagger and sort of an ironic like bravado. He's almost kind of a Freddie Mercury-ish figure. it's Freddie Mercury as a cult leader, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there have been a lot of films with, you know, evil gang of punk rockers. Of course, Mad Max and Road Warrior really instituted the, and the Warriors itself really instituted a lot of those tropes, or at least modernized them from the previous era of, you know, of chaotic, destructive biker gang films, of which Hugh Keysburn was a main character in the great Australian biker film Stone. And gets a couple of really nice scenes in that. I mean, he's just a phenomenal actor. He plays just the swagger he's got in Mad Max, and like that. There's sort of a weird level of poetry to the villains in Mad Max, and like a very sort of Manson cultish homoerotic vibe to it. It's just a lot of weird mingling of influences that I don't think had been really seen in movie villains at that point.
Yeah, it's hard to really pin down Toe Cutter's personality, because there's just a little bit of all of these elements that you're mentioning. He's a little flamboyant. You know, he is a little crazy, and he's a... just like you said, he's got a swagger to him, so there's some confidence there as well. So it's just he's one of those villains that you just can't put into one one category.
Yeah, for like the kind despite the fact that like he's leading, like he's basically the leader of a biker gang, which is a classic movie, or outlaw gang, which classic movie villain trope. Like, the way he's going to react to things is unpredictable. Like, you know, I think there's a point early on where they're at a train station, and they're intimidating the worker there, because I think they're waiting for the body of Knight Rider, the crony of theirs who gets killed in the opening car chase. And the guy is terrified, says whatever you want, and Toe Cutter repeats that, whatever you want, what a wonderful philosophy you have. And and it's like, you know, I see echoes of that moment in the call it friendo scene in No Country for Old Men.
Oh yeah, okay.
I mean, of course, you know, it's a classic sort of hassling the low level worker, hassling the shopkeep scene, but it's done in such a tense, uncertain way, like, because you genuinely don't know if he's going to cause injury or death to this guy, and you get the sense that even he's not sure yet.
Yeah, definitely. There's some bouts of unpredictability there throughout Mad Max when Toe Cutter's on screen.
Yeah, he's just an awesome, awesome villain.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a segue for your cue, Joel.
Yeah. I went a little more recent with this, maybe a little bit after the VHS era, but this is another strange, unpredictable villain. I went with Kitano from Battle Royale.
Oh, okay.
And Chris, I'm not sure if you're familiar with Battle Royale. We've never really talked about it before.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I can't say I've seen the whole thing, but I have caught parts of it previously.
So Kitano is named after the actor who plays him, Takeshi Kitano, who is also a director, comedian, real jack of all trades in Japan, interesting public figure in Japan. And for those of you who, you know, haven't seen Battle Royale or are only familiar with the Hunger Games comparisons people have made, basically, to curb down on delinquency, Japan has instituted a program where they, in a sort of dystopian, you know, vague future, very 5 minutes into the future kind of thing, they've instituted a program where every so often, every year, like one ninth grade class from Japan will be picked to fight to the death on an island in a very Hunger Games, Lord of the Flies kind of manner. And Kitano plays the former teacher of this class, who is now working with the government and has organized this iteration of the games. So he appears throughout the movie from the headquarters, an old, what looks like school building on the island, reading off announcements, reading off who's died, reading off where the danger zones are, that if you step in, like, your explosive collar that the students are forced to wear to keep them playing the game will go off. And he does it with this very sort of a certain level of glee. But it's also very, it's not really understated, but it's just like glee from a man who hasn't felt happy in years and is still trying to figure out how to express it. Because all we've seen of him, like, in terms of flashbacks, is that he's absolutely, like, you know, an embittered, absolutely miserable teacher who clearly hates his life, like, the kids hate him. The best friend of the main character at one point slashes him with a knife, like, way before the events of the film. Like, he just ambushes him in the hallway, slashes his leg with a switchblade. But there's a lot of weird levels to him. He's not as sadistic as, like, a lot of, because there have been multiple iterations of Battle Royale and comics, and of course the original novel, the sequel movie. And he's a lot less, like, of a sadistic bastard as like, a lot of the other characters who are in his position. And he's also very sort of, he's very obsessed. He's fixated on the female lead in the film, Noriko. And you're never sure exactly what kind of fixation it is, whether it's a lust obsession, or at one point near the end you hear him on the phone arguing with his own daughter. So whether it's because, like, Noriko's such a genuinely, like, sweet girl that he is you know, enamored of the idea of this girl being his daughter, having a family that he can actually be happy with. Like, he actually, like, weirdly shows up in one scene, like, outside the base on the island in the middle of the games and scares off one of the more psychotic characters from Noriko, gives her, like, an umbrella and tells her not to catch cold. Like, over the course of the film, you see him, like, working on a painting, and then finally at the end you see it, and he was painting all the students, like, various ways of death with, like, this very angelic Noriko, like, right in the center of it. Like, he's clearly, like, sort of partly manipulating this whole thing to save her.
Right. Yeah, one thing to mention though, I want to bring up since it's on my mind before I forget, is that I don't know how it is now with school. Obviously, I'm not a student. I don't have any younger relatives or anything that are currently in school, so I don't know. But back when I went to school, you always had that one teacher, kind of like how you're describing Kitano, who's miserable and just a miserable bastard or a battle axe and just out to make life miserable for all the students, and, you know, give them a long-ass school year on top of it. And so, you know, I had, you know, my fair share of teachers like that throughout my course. So I guess I think that's totally relatable.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's like every, like, hard-ass, awful teacher you've ever had. And I also, Takeshi Kitano has hosted a number of game shows in Japan, and I think a lot of, like, his casting here was kind of a stunt to recall his, recall for audiences his, you know, the game shows he hosted, like, has a very strange take on that. But yeah, I mean, has, like, that teacher you hate, he's so good at that.
Yeah, that was kind of like what they did with Richard Dawson in The Running Man as Killian.
Oh yeah,
who almost made my list, by the way.
He'd be a great choice.
All right, so that's your number four, Joe.
Yep.
And that's a good selection. And I guess we'll move on to my number three on my list. And this is a film that I just recently reviewed at RetroMovieNerd.com. It's Universal Soldier. And I went with Dolph Lundgren's crazy cracker-ass Sergeant Andrew Scott. Because, you know, I'm watching Universal Soldier, of course, is an enjoyable film. But it's enjoyable because I believe Dolph Lundgren just steals the show in this one.
Oh, my gosh.
Say what you will about Lundgren's acting ability. I mean, we've seen him as Ivan Drago. He was one note as Ivan Drago, but it was a good note. Of course, we won't mention him as He-Man because I think he was miscast. But anyway, that's another story. But as Andrew Scott, Sergeant Andrew Scott in Universal Soldier, I think this is his best role outside of Ivan Drago. He's just off his rocker in this movie. I mean, he made a necklace out of ears. and one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he's threading these ears onto the necklace and someone approaches him with a question, and he holds up the necklace and goes, "I am all ears," and he's got the shit eating grin on his face, and part of me thinks it's because Lundgren you know, broke character there for a moment because he couldn't believe the shit he was saying. he was not afraid to go over the top in this role. He did not hold back. He just went with it. He's got a couple of good one-liners in the movie. But not only that, of course, he's just just one of those tough, badass villains that takes a while for our hero Jean-Claude Van Damme to defeat, but defeat him he eventually does, of course, as all these stories go. But this is one of those underappreciated characters throughout the movies that no one seems to mention or give credit for, but I'm doing it right now. And I'm giving credit to Dolph Lundgren for pulling off Sergeant Andrew Scott from Universal Soldier.
You know, it's funny that you say that about Dolph being miscast in Masters of the Universe, because I totally get what you mean. Dolph, like, you know, I think a lot of filmmakers have wanted him to be either, like, the tough, heroic guy or the, like, you know, the very straightforward, like, cold Russian villain. But Dolph is at his best when he's off kilter. Like, that's why he was easily the best part of the Expendables, because he basically seemed to be playing, like, a slightly more heroic version of his role in Universal Soldier.
Yes. But,
like, he's best when he's, like, a wild card type, because he's so good at being weird and unpredictable.
Right. He actually knows how to go over the top with it. He actually has... You can see him having fun with it.
And oh,
you know, chewing the scenery and going over the top is just... It's probably got to be a dream opportunity for a lot of actors, because there's just no bounds to hold you back. You can just go off the wall and there's no one to stop you, because that's what the intention is in a character like this.
Oh, yeah, especially when you get something like, you know, The Expendables, where like, you've got a ton of actors everyone knows, and they're all playing sort of variations on their established types. Like, you know, Sylvester Stallone's playing, like, old Rambo. Like, Jason Statham's playing Jason Statham. Like
Jet Li's, Jason Statham.
Yeah, Jet Li's playing Jet Li. They're just playing themselves, basically, or yeah. They're, like, you know, classic persona. Like, Dolph Lundgren gets to be so gloriously weird and stuff like that. And, like, Universal Soldier, because he's playing up against Van Damme, was playing just a variation on the Jean-Claude Van Damme type.
Yeah, like, Van Damme is... You know, there's charisma there in Van Damme, but the character in this instance, and it may be Van Damme's interpretation of a guy who's just coming out of, like, a slumber, you know, a mechanically or drug-induced slumber for, like, 27 years or however long it was. But Van Damme is kind of bland in this movie, Lundgren just is the complete opposite.
Oh, yeah. Van Damme's charisma is, like, largely physical charisma. Like, when he's actually moving, when he's in action, he moves so fluidly and so like, wonderfully, like, you're immediately engaged with... He's not, like, on, say, Jet Li's level in terms of, this guy is basically, like, Fred Astaire doing roundhouse kicks, but... Yeah. He's not far off in terms of being able to draw you in just by moving around. Like, he's really great at that, but I mean, you know, he's at the acting part, not so much.
No,
Dolph, partly because everyone expects a certain type out of him, or one of two certain types out of him, and partly because he's so good at just letting go, and partly because he's just such a weird presence anyway. He's got, like, an amazing natural charisma. I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen the video that makes the rounds on YouTube. It's from some foreign awards show. He's doing this performance of Elvis's A Little Less Conversation.
I've not seen that.
Stops in the middle of the performance to do a drum solo and then to break blocks, like, with karate chops, and then goes back to singing.
It sounds awesome.
It's the greatest thing ever made. Like, it's just, like, pure Dolph Lundgren. This is just... If you need to explain Dolph Lundgren to someone in 3 minutes, this is what you use. And yeah. It's not even from a movie. It's insane.
Yeah, another one of my favorite scenes in Universal Soldier is when... his character, Scott, Andrew Scott, is he's dragging his Unisol buddies into the meat locker in the grocery store, and he's in the grocery store just losing his shit, talking about Vietnamese, you know, being around all the corners, and then, you know, the cops bust in on him to try and take him down, and he kills them all, and he's like, "See what I mean? They're everywhere." And he's just losing his shit inside the grocery store. That's another classic scene.
Whenever you could put Dolph Lundgren losing his shit in a place where people don't normally lose their shit, it immediately makes life 10 times better.
Yeah. So, yeah. Dolph Lundgren as Sergeant Andrew Scott in Universal Soldier, number 3 on my list.
Number 3 on my list, we're going a bit more faceless with this one. We've talked about really a lot of very unique personas, a lot of very singular like personalities. I'm going a bit wider with this. This is from the Alien series, and I'm not going with the aliens. I'm going with Weyland-Yutani Corporation.
Oh, those evil bastards.
Those sons of bitches. And those sons of bitches. Like, of course, when I say Weyland-Yutani, most people immediately think of course, Carter Burke, Paul Reiser's performance in Aliens as, like, the ultimate scumbag, like, sleazy, obsequious yuppie character. And, you know, he was great in that role. So great that apparently when he went to the premiere, he brought his parents. And when he was killed, they just sternly nodded like this was the correct thing to happen.
That was the correct thing to happen. That, oh, what a scumbag.
But I wanted to bring up the Weyland-Yutani Corporation because, like, their position in these films... You know, I like the films haven't gone too far in making this company, like, you know, the ones who control the whole plot line, because, you know, those kinds of narratives, they can get very tiresome unless you've got, like, something like Soylent Green, where that's the whole world you're in. But, you know, doing that in your bug monster movie is not as fun. But I wanted to bring up talk about context of Weyland-Yutani, like in terms of 1986. When I was coming up with my villain list, I was reading some articles about just unrelated. Reading some articles about Monsanto.
Oh, Monsanto.
And you know, their rise as sort of an agribusiness firm, and reading about Dow Chemical and the way they moved into sort of a agricultural and biological sciences firm that has, like, they've moved all their chemical and textile operations, the ones that have, you know, been sued, been beset with controversy for years and years, moved those to, like, an offshoot corporation. So, yeah, the Dow name won't be so sullied by lawsuits anymore. And, of course, you know, Aliens, although people don't talk about Amor was, you know, when it came out, considered to be a Vietnam movie.
Right, yeah.
You know, a bunch of hard-ass soldiers go into foreign territory and get torn apart by these... unknowable creatures who use their, you know, advanced knowledge of their own homeland to, you know, outsmart and ambush these superior smarter soldiers. I mean, like, calling them creatures makes the whole metaphor sound a bit racist, but I don't think that was the intention. So, and of course, Dow being so involved in Vietnam, producing Agent Orange, you know, was widely known at this point. It was very much, you know, the idea of this military industrial complex, that the military working side by side with these, like, draconian corporations with these weird medieval structures to them, making, like, every product you've ever used in your life without even, like, you realizing it.
Yeah.
And then the corporation, in a weird way, having more agency and more authority and power than the military. And also being, like that idea was really starting to come into its own, you know, in the post-Vietnam era. And even more so, the idea of, I mean, it seems almost ridiculous. Like, why do these guys want to, like, steal, like, alien life forms? What are they going to possibly do with these organisms that are basically bred to kill and breed again? But, you know, there's some interesting context here. In 1980, there was a major Supreme Court case, Diamond versus Chakrabarty, which established that genetically modified organisms can be patented, which is the precedent that Dow and Monsanto have heavily used for their especially Monsanto, developing strains of crops that are resistant to their pesticide weed killers and selling that selling them to farmers so farmers can grow these and use the weed killers and pesticides that these plants are that aren't going to like affect these plants. Like the idea that you can patent a living organism is to me a very, even if it's a germ, even if it's a strain of plant, a breed of dog, like these, a certain kind of like extremely hot pepper that you want to bring to like, pepper eating contest for people who forgot what food is supposed to be for. It's almost, God, it's weird. It's going to make me sound weird to say blasphemous, but the idea that it can be patented does ring of blasphemy to me. Like there's just something, anti-life in it. This idea, I think, I'm not sure exactly how important the court case was in the national mind, the national mindset, like around this time. I mean, it was 1986, years before Aliens came out, but. And we're certainly seeing the effects of it now with the way how Monsanto and Dow have used this precedent to establish a new kind of business, a life sciences kind of business for themselves. But it's a fascinating idea, and it makes what Weyland-Yutani does in Aliens less like a sci-fi trope and more a weird, almost Soylent Greenish take on the future than you would assume otherwise from an Aliens film.
Yeah, that makes sense. After all is said and done, it's just I always thought though, and this was just me though. I always thought that Weyland-Yutani was always after the acidic blood for some reason, rather than the creature itself. You know, they hope to contain the creature long enough to just extract whatever is within the creature itself. But that was just one thing I thought about Weyland-Yutani's purpose in this whole thing. What you're saying is actually makes a lot more sense.
It's like the films themselves, or at least the tone of the film, seem to imply that there's something like crazy sinister going on. Like, oh, they want to manufacture like these aliens as like a new breed of military weapon. But knowing what we know about companies like Weyland-Yutani, like they're probably gonna like figure out what to manufacture the aliens' acidic blood and make it like an industrial solvent or something.
Exactly.
It's gonna be totally mundane and totally disappointing. It's not. They're not gonna make some like impossibly indestructible alien super soldier. They're just gonna make stuff with industrial uses that's totally boring and mundane because evil is banal.
Yeah, there you go. So that is actually a very interesting choice for your number three there, Joel, and a lot of good research went into that, obviously.
It was a long rant, but we got there. And it totally accidentally. It was just when you talked about the topic, I was already like reading articles about this when I, not at work, obviously, because I would never do that.
Monsanto and Netflix, sons of bitches.
Just wait till Netflix starts like colorizing old films or inserting like Walter White into Scarface or something.
You shut your whore mouth. Well, I think we've got some good ones on the list so far, Joel. I think we're going to hit up the break, though, for a minute. We got a promo to run, and we're going to do that. When we come back, we each have two remaining on our list, and we're going to get better and better in terms of sci-fi, fantasy, villainy. So stay with us, and we'll be back in just a few.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. We're talking top five favorite sci-fi fantasy villains here on Go Home in the Box. We've each run down our bottom three choices so far, and they've all been very good selections, very well thought out, and we're going to continue on. We each have a top two remaining. And then when we're done, we're going to get into another round of Stump Joel.
Oh.
Joel is excited. And I think I've got a tougher round of questions for you this week, Joel.
Oh. It's all tech noirs all the time.
The answer to every question is tech noir.
I'll never figure it out.
Well, let's move on with it then. We'll start. Number two on my list, and you know him and you love him, and you kneel before him. It's Terrence Stamp as General Zod in Superman 2. So much goodness here to talk about. I mean, just the catchphrase, of course, kneel before Zod. His insistence on everybody kneeling before him. I mean, that was part of the awesomeness. But, you know, yeah, you had the confidence level of Zod. You know, here he is on Earth. He realizes he has superpowers because of the yellow sun. And he's like a king among ants. As, you know, he sees an opportunity to rule this place. Of course, there's one man in his way. The son of Jor-El himself, Superman. And he, with the advice of Gene Hackman, is Lex Luthor. Let me ask you a question real quick, Joe. The character of Lex Luthor is never depicted as a guy that I've always depicted him. You know, in the comic books, he's just this ruthless... you know, brainiac of a villain, but yet in the movies he's more of a comic centerpiece. I mean, even Kevin Spacey, who's a more serious actor, you know, there was a little something off kilter with that character.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they went that way with Lex. You know, I'm not sure if this was sort of predating Lex as the Ubermensch businessman that he would become, especially in the I'd imagine that was very largely part of the John Byrne run that began in the 80s after the Crisis on Infinite Earths, after the reboot there. But
yeah,
you know, that's like the idea of Lex as businessman seemed to be very much in the air already, and I don't know. And obviously he is in the in the Donner movies, but I don't know if Gene Hackman wanted to play it, you know, a bit more fun, or if Donner wanted a bit of campiness to it. It's unusual because I'm so used to that Ubermensch Lex in the comics. I'm used to Clancy Brown playing him in the Justice League cartoons, but that's how I see Lex. And I do, like, Gene Hackman's amazing, but he can obviously be more serious as an actor than he is as Lex Luthor.
Yeah, and of course we just kept getting worse. Of course we you know, Jesse Eisenberg.
Okay,
we'll stop right there. We'll stop with Joel's exasperation with just the name itself.
to be fair, I have not seen Man of Steel, so I also won't, or Batman versus Superman, so I won't have anything to say about. Really, a say about Jesse Eisenberg as Lex, except that like modernizing him to be a Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos kind of like evil millennial is at least an interesting idea. It's not really what I want out of Lex, but as a character type, it's not a bad idea. And unfortunately, I don't have anything to say about Michael Shannon as General Zod because I haven't seen Man of Steel, so that you know, I don't know how his portrayal might differ from Terrence Stamp's.
Yeah, well, that I was going to say, but we digress. And this is about General Zod and Terrence Stamp's version of him. And like I was saying, just the all around gloriousness of this character. The overconfidence as being all powerful on Earth. He cuckolds the president, and if you look closely, the president in Superman 2 kind of does sort of resemble Ronald Reagan. And so, I mean, he cuckolds the president to kneeling before Zod, and then. Of course, we get the climactic showdown in the Fortress of Solitude between the three villains and Superman himself, where he outsmarts them. He outthinks them. That leads to the defeat of General Zod. But prior to that, Zod is just one of those, you know, almost campy, but He's not campy enough to be in like a Batman episode of the old Batman series, but you know there's a little bit of campiness there, but it just leads to some memorable scenes from that movie. And I think Superman 2 really is the strongest of, you know, the original Superman the films, and it's mainly because of Terrence Stamp's performance as Zod.
Oh yeah, there's definitely like a level of camp. Like, he's a very theatrical villain, almost like upon realizing he's all powerful, he becomes sort of a broad parody of like a Shakespearean king.
Yeah,
like of course you have someone like Terrence Stamp, a huge, imposing, very classical style actor in this role. Like, he has that element of such seriousness. He's so deadpan that it's like easy to, like, with a little bit of nudge, make it a bit camp with the right tone. And Superman 2, like the Donner Superman movies always sort of inclined towards camp. And I know there were issues with the making of Superman 2. I think what Donner ended up sort of leaving it and was recut by Richard Fleischer, something like that.
Yeah.
Richard Lester, I'm sorry. Richard Fleischer gave us
the Superman cartoons. Was it?
No, that was a different Fleischer. Richard Fleischer gave us I believe Fantastic Voyage and a number of other films, but around this time gave us Amityville 3D.
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to our backstage historian, Roxy.
Yeah. Yes, thank you, Roxy.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so anyway, absolutely correct about Stamp's performance as Zod. It is somewhat theatrical and lends itself towards some comic moments, but just in terms of the character and his scope and what he envisions himself as, we need that, you know, that megalomaniacal attitude in our supervillains, the kind that want to rule the world, and they could very easily do it if they can just get Superman out of the way. And it's just a terrific villain.
Well, you know, it's funny now thinking that Richard Lester, who I think most people would know from Hard Day's Night and Help, the Beatles movies, also directed A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the film adaptation of the stage musical, which features the completely megalomaniacal general Milos Gloriosus, or Captain Milos Gloriosus, I believe. Thinking about that, it's sort of easy to see Terrence Stamp's General Zod has like a bit more serious, like, descendant of Gloriosus, and A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. He's definitely playing with that awareness of how ridiculous his arrogance is.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with that. And it's his arrogance, really, that is a good feature about the villain, because especially in the comic book, from the comic book world, you know, the supervillains, you want them to be arrogant, you want them to, you know, be megalomaniacal and have this large scope. You know, they're just one step away from ruling the world, and they have every confidence to believe that they can do it. This is the latest plot to rid the world of Superman or whoever the case is, and we can do it, gosh darn it. And that attitude is prevalent in Zod, and overconfidence leads to his downfall when, you know, Superman just, you know, outthinks them, based on his working knowledge, of course, of his own Fortress of Solitude. This is the role that made me really love Superman 2 as a kid. It was all about General Zod, and I could care less about Clark Kent when he gave up his Superman powers. You know, there's a couple of things left unexplained in that movie based on around that scenario, but Whenever Terrence Stamp and company were on screen, that's when, you know, I paid attention.
There were a lot of potential plot holes with Superman 2, but I mean, you know, Terrence Stamp pulls it together more than admirably.
Yeah. Yeah. So, tell us, Joel, who you have for your number two.
Well, number two, I went extremely modern with this one. It's also the second appearance of an actor on our two lists. Of a franchise. I picked for number two, Hugh Keyes Byrne has Immortan Joe in Mad Max Fury Road.
Awesome. Awesome performance.
And it really says something about Hugh Keyes Byrne that he played two different villains on the same franchise, and they're both totally different. I mean, Immortan Joe is a huge, imposing, you know, godlike figure. And, of course, he's built himself up this way. But it's also, like, it's also that he's built an entire... He's done what, like, none of the other Mad Max villains have really done, and built a functional, if totally tyrannical, society around him. Like, you know, we've had Mad Max villains who led gangs, who led, you know, groups of bandits and raiders, but for one to have built like entire society in the rubble, the destroyed world, and despite how, you know, horrible it is, it's still functional, is a pretty amazing feat for a villain in a post-apocalyptic film. And not only has he built the society, he's built an entire weird culture, like, in it. You know, he's got his fanatical gang of warriors, the War Boys, who are all, you know, dying over the course, due to what's been done to them to make them warriors. And he's created this religion around himself, this warrior Valhalla-ish religion built around battle glory and vehicles, like built around chrome and gasoline, like use the language of these of the machinery that keeps their society alive, and built a religion around that. That's just an amazing, like, background to the, and, you know, immersive world of this film, and he's at the center of it. And visually, of course, all Mad Max villains have great visuals, but, you know, his skull mask, like his respirator, his long, like, you know, bleached out hair, and his, like, you know, just white dead skin, like, he's just a horrifying, grotesque image. And at the same time, you can understand why he's the leader of this horrific world, because, I mean, just looking at him, you can see, like, why he just owns the world around him.
Yeah, and you can see, I think there's, in terms of the Mad Max films, I think there's, like, a progression there.
Yeah.
Amongst the villains. We start off very, very, I don't want to say basic, but scattershot. You've got, like, the motorcycle gang led by Toe Cutter, which evolves into a ragtag group of barbarians led by Lord Humongous. And then we've got, in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, you've got Anti-Entity, played by Tina Turner. Now there's, you see the formation of a society there. And then, of course, Immortan Joe just blows the whole thing up and makes it much larger in scope. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, in terms of the Mad Max films, you see that progression amongst the villains from the bottom working their way up to the top, like Immortan Joe.
Yeah, I love that progression, that, like, we're getting deeper and deeper into the post-apocalypse and actually seeing society very slowly reform and go through those progressions of almost like the early Mad Max villains are like the hunter-gatherer phase of human of human civilization, and now we're getting into, like, war, like, regional warlords with tyrannical holds on the world around them. And yeah, Road Warrior was doing that too, but we're getting even more advanced where it's not just that he's a warlord, it's that he's a warlord with a whole social order around him with, you know, they have a level of sustainment. They've managed to find a few places at a certain altitude where they can still grow crops. They have like hydroponic gardens. They've managed to like find and maintain a water source. They manufacture weapons and bullets. It's far beyond like anything we've seen in a Mad Max film in terms of like the ability to keep this world going. I mean, the question about Immortan Joe is that, like, has Mad and as evil a tyrant as he is, like, the world he's built functionally works. It's not a nice world. It's not a world like you'd want to be a normal civilian is, but it's running. Which is, then you have the question. And of course, you know, the film ends with on a hopeful note. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that Furiosa could run the society even better, and with more equity, with more, you know, with less tyranny, less oppression. But you know, like unfortunately, you have to remind yourself that Joe is the one who put this structure in place, and you have to question with a world as far gone as the Mad Max world, if Joe's methods aren't really the most stable methods for that time, until you get someone who can competently replace him, like Furiosa, who for all you can say about her, and she is a genuinely like humane person. Like, it seems like so much of what she learned, she probably learned from Joe.
Yeah, and you know, something like that has to start somewhere, whether it is from madness or whatever the case is. You know, it's if you think about it, you know, when civilization was progressing, even I'm talking in terms of our own history here, there are people who were probably thought that, you know, so and so was crazy for having invented this or built that, and so I mean, you can look at it that way from that point of view as well. And Immortan Joe, you know, he's creating this whole society, this whole religion, everything wrapped around it, and there's got to be people, you know, the perception is that he's crazy, but you know, there was a method to his madness and there was a purpose for it, and you know, there, and like you said, there would be hope at the end that maybe it's just gonna keep progressing and become more, I guess, humane would be the word for it eventually.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, for all his tyranny, for all his madness, seems to have an innate understanding of what a society needs to function. Like, he seems to have a vision that we haven't really seen before in a Mad Max villain. And, you know, unfortunately, there's the sense that with his vision and ability and willpower, like, he's the one who was needed to, like, start the world towards civilization again. In a weird way. I mean, like you said, the progression of the villains, it really does mimic prehistoric human civilization, progressing from nomadism, hunter gathering, to tribalism, to, you know, a sustainable farming civilization. Like, that's one of the really most layered, interesting things about the Mad Max films.
Yeah. So there's definitely kind of like a reflection on our own history there within that film series. And with that said, I think it's time to move on to my number one, Joel. And this is one that has been talked about quite often. I was kind of hesitant to put a mainstream movie villain here in this spot. Nothing against the mainstream, but when there's certain films out there that have been talked to death, you have a tendency to avoid them because, hey, everyone has seen the movie, everyone has their opinion on it. But this is one of those characters where it's justified in continuing to talk about it because it's just visually and from an acting standpoint as well. This is just an absolute great character and my favorite sci-fi fantasy villain. From Terminator 2 Judgment Day, it's the T-1000, as played by Robert Patrick. Now this dude, I mean, he doesn't get a lot of dialogue in the film, but a lot of what he does is through his face, his eyes. I mean, this is one ice-cold motherfucker. And the best part is he just keeps coming. And, you know, he's different from the original Terminator played by Arnold Schwarzenegger. In fact, of course, that he's the liquid metal version where you can't really seem to maim him in any way because he just pieces himself back together. He just, you know, and this is quite the inventive character by James Cameron and company. To even consider, you know, having a... Because it just opened a door for, you know, Cameron to invent, you know, more fancy special effects. And the special effects revolved around the T-1000 were quite revolutionary at the time. And they still hold up, even today. You know, with all the CGI we have right now, the T-1000 was the front runner of that, and it still holds up in this cinematic era as well. But, I mean, the performance of Robert Patrick, you can't have the T-1000. You can have all the special effects around the T-1000 you want. If Robert Patrick isn't giving this ice-cold performance, then it doesn't really work as well. And, I think he's the better Terminator than the original. Putting that out there. And even though, you know, even though Schwarzenegger keeps coming back for all the subsequent sequels, but, you know, the T-1000, I believe, is the better model Terminator. And it's just... But, again, like I said, without Robert Patrick, given the performance that he does with, you know, the facial features and just the ice-cold stare, and it's just awesome to see. And it's my pick for my favorite sci-fi fantasy villain.
Now, that's a great choice. And, you know, Terminator 2 did so many brilliant things. I mean, like... Of course, because it's a sequel, you have to go bigger in some way. And... The idea of making and like how you go bigger than Arnold Schwarzenegger, you can't, but you can actually go more capable. And like having a more advanced model Terminator, I mean, you know, something not only sleeker but able to replicate shapes, able to replicate people, like one that isn't just difficult to destroy. It reforms itself. I mean, those are all brilliant concepts. And like the idea of making Arnold Schwarzenegger an underdog is almost a joke, but it actually they managed to do it.
That's right.
And of course, not only in concept, the T-1000 is brilliant, but yeah, Robert Patrick is amazing. Like I remember reading that he based a lot of his body language, the way he walks, the way he like holds his head, he leads with his nose, his head just sort of tilted forward. Like he based it on looking at footage of eagles and hunting hawks as they swooped in on prey. And like if you Google image search the T-1000 and look at just Robert Patrick's face, the way his ears stick out, like because he does have ears that kind of stick out, especially with that like, you know, crew cut he's got going on as the police officer, and the way he's got a very sharp nose, the way the nose sticks forward, it really almost looks like the silhouette of a bird. It's really fascinating. And of course, you know, him not only being able to replicate shapes and voices, but of course, choosing to be in the guise of this cop the entire time. So it's literally like an implacable authority figure. I mean, early on when he's got the mirrored sunglasses, like the Chain Gang Warden from Cool Hand Luke, which I'm sure is a tribute. Like, he's just completely unblinking, unreasoning authority that is going to stop at nothing to take people down. Like, it's just such a great image. So, there's so much hanging on that image, and he's like, his body language is absolutely so perfect. Like,
yeah, I love the way he runs when he's running after them. Just the way his arms are moving at his side. It is, even though he's made of liquid metal, it is still very robotic looking.
Yeah,
he's like symmetrical when he's running.
It's like watching a geometric figure move, almost like a skeletal figure you'd see in like a computer animation test run. It's a bit like Yul Brynner in Westworld. It's funny because it's weird because he's so swift and so stiff at the same time.
Exactly. And that's a good comparison, because I just recently saw Yul Brynner in Westworld, and I couldn't help but see some of Robert Patrick's performance in there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, James Cameron, I guess, said that if, like, the Arnold Termeyer is like a Panzer tank, the T-1000 is a Porsche. But I think now you'd say if Arnold's a Panzer tank, the T-1000 is a drone. because he's just...
Except the T-1000 is not going to be delivering packages to your front door.
Oh, Amazon, you make even the deadliest things mundane. See, it's like Weyland Yutani.
Exactly.
You've got the technology to make a T-1000, and he just delivers your iPad.
And then he walks away.
Yeah, but angrily.
Oh yeah, so that would be a great idea of Weyland Yutani in the Terminator world, actually.
Oh my god, I feel like there's gotta be a Dark Horse comic about that by this point, right?
Yeah, So that's a good idea. We should progress it from there, Joel. Yeah. So anyway,
Dark Horse, if you're listening, we're ready.
Yeah. So. Number one on my list, Robert Patrick as the T-1000 from Terminator 2, the most badass villain in movie history. Not named Darth Vader, who did not make my list. So I don't know what I'm thinking.
Oh, Vader. So number one on my list was going to be Robert Patrick in The Marine, obviously.
Oh, obviously. Oh, yeah, because anyone who torments John Cena is going to be number one in your book, right?
I don't have much against John Cena. He's not my favorite wrestler, but I have a basic respect for the man. Number one on my list is actually, I believe, the only female villain on the list we've done, as well as the only animated villain, and that's from Disney's 1959 Sleeping Beauty, Maleficent.
Oh, Maleficent. It's a good thing you clarified it's the animated Disney version and not the Angelina Jolie version.
And the Angelina Jolie version is more of sort of a revisionist sort of anti-hero Maleficent. Lately, like, especially because that Maleficent's been much more visible in Disney products. She's been a character in Once Upon a Time. Disney Channel has this franchise Descendants with the children of some of Disney's major villains. And Kristen Chenoweth is like one of the perkiest women ever. Like, perky enough to play Easter, the goddess Easter on American Gods, is playing Maleficent, which has to be some kind of like amusing joke casting. Maleficent, I love partly because there's, like I said earlier, there's like sword and sorcery movies, fantasy movies, they often have like a couple of distinct types of villains. It's always like an evil sorcerer or an evil warlord. I mean, even Darth Vader, in a sense, is an evil sorcerer.
Yeah.
Darth Vader is a bit more interesting because he's a fallen hero, and that's always a bit more interesting than just a guy who's, evil because, that's what he's here to do. But, you know, the very Lord of the Rings, Sauron and Saruman kind of dynamic. One second, Greg.
Yeah, sure. Right. Tell her it's okay. Tell her it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay. It's me. Is everything okay?
Everything's fine.
All right, let's repeat that. Yeah. Sorry. So it's a very sort of Lord of the Rings thing. I mean, that's where so many of these archetypes come from. You know, there's an evil warlord who might also be sorcerer, like sorcery inclined. There's an evil sorcerer like Christopher Lee Saruman, and they're there to do evil because that's what they are. You know, usually it's assumed that there's not much motivation beyond just a lust for power. And that's fine because so many of those movies are heroes' journeys, and you basically just need them to go up against someone more powerful than them. But Maleficent's interesting to me because so much of what she does, it's almost more of like a Lucifer thing, where so much of what she does is built out of like injured pride. I mean, she curses an infant princess to die when she's 16 because she wasn't invited to like the celebration of this child's birth. Like she's so
spiteful.
It's nothing but spite. She you know, freezes an entire kingdom, destroys an entire kingdom's line of succession just because she wasn't invited to a party. That's absolutely amazing.
You know, she needed to go on Facebook and just make a vague post pointing out this indiscretion.
And that's the thing. That's probably what Facebook's good for now, is that, like, the sorceresses among us who can turn into dragons and curse children to die on their 16th birthday just, like, vague book now, and they don't really, like, you know,
they don't level name, curses. They don't name names. They just say, you know who you are.
Yeah. No, I mean, and Maleficent, like, is a great character to revise because you can understand why people would want to see her in an anti-hero role. Of course, the fact that Angelina Jolie is around as an actress, where she's one of the only major actresses with that kind of gravity and intensity and style to her, that she could be Maleficent. Like, you know, just it's understandable why you would want to make that, especially in a modern age, into like the sort of post-feminist revisionist anti-hero, because like obviously what she's railing against, like this very formal mannered idea of a medieval court and succession, like you can understand why someone would hate that. That's not how our world operates anymore, at least theoretically. Like, or at least in ideal, like she's awesome partly because, for as spiteful as she is, you can imprint on her. You can view her as a more rebellious character rather than an imperious sort of imperious but fundamentally a singular and very alone like figure. She's a sorceress. She has her own castle. She's sort of queen of her own domain. She's got, you know, her raven familiar, and she's got all these little like goblin like toadies running around doing her will. But she's fundamentally alone, which is, I mean, she doesn't have a kingdom. She doesn't seem to have any children or successors. She's just ruling over like a kingdom of one, basically.
Right, and of course, she has the added bonus of also being in an animated world, and of course, in animation, you can pretty much, from a physical aspect, make her look, you know, much more threatening than you could with, you know, say, like a makeup job in a live-action film. And just, the animated feature of this character, you know, adds, you know, another layer to it.
Yeah, you know, they did like brilliant things with the makeup, with the prosthetics on Angelina Jolie in the Maleficent film, like to like adapt that very angular style of her character design in this movie. Like, you know, her face is so hard edge. Yeah. Like, you know, she's got that great imperious voice. Eleanor Audley, who was Cinderella's evil stepmother in Cinderella, like, she did the voice. I mean, the voice just absolutely drips with wickedness and malice. It's just there's partly she's number one on my list because she subverts a lot of, or at least deepens a lot of tropes of fantasy villains. Like, she's got reasons for what she does. They're very spiteful, very petty reasons, but for the most part, but she's got reasons that you could even expand on. I mean, like, everything she's seen, the way she lives seems to be almost like this dark parody of the way, like, this, like, nice medieval kingdom right beside her is living. She's fundamentally, like, and, you know, not only is she a sorceress, but she's a fairy. I mean, the original Sleeping Beauty story, like, she's more a sorceress or witch in the Disney version, but, like, in contrast to the three sort of comedic, bumbling, but ultimately capable good fairies in Sleeping Beauty, she's, you know, an evil queen fairy.
Right, yeah. And so, yeah, there's that aspect of her as well. I mean, in sword and sorcery type films, you've got sorcerers and sorceresses, and sometimes, you know, in a live action film, it's kind of difficult to, you know, kind of like depict a fairy in the live action world. I mean, they did it in Hook with Julia Roberts, but I mean, a lot of stuff like that, a lot of movies like that, they don't really bring in a character like this. I don't know. I don't want to say corny, but, you know, adding a fairy to a sword and sorcery type film is not all that common for whatever the reason may be. But, you know, here in Sleeping Beauty, you know, just having the good fairy, bad fairy dynamic is another dimension to the film.
Yeah, and, you know, you can pull off, like, that kind of genre melding in, like, an animated film better than a live-action film, because so many of our live-action sword and sorcery films are either based on sort of epic Tolkien-style fantasy, which is more descended from, like, you know, Wagnerian opera and, like, Norse myth and Celtic myth, or, you know, you do, like, the heroic fantasy, like the Robert E. Howard Conan-style stuff, but it doesn't leave room for, like, things like fae folk, like, more fairy tale oriented creatures, which in their own way can be very weird and alien and inhuman, or can be very threatening. Like, we don't see as much of that in fantasy film. I mean, if we do, it's usually like an animated film or one that's a little more feminine oriented, like Labyrinth, a little more a little younger oriented too, like Labyrinth. You know, so of course Sleeping Beauty counts under that, but, you know, but what interests me is that they took that sort of context and made their villain, like, you know, this absolute, like, queen of all evil sorceresses.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, Maleficent, that's a good choice, Joel. Very interesting choice, and going with an animated film at that as well. So, definitely a choice to talk about. I mean, there's so many layers to it, so. So, yeah, good choice for your number one.
And all I'm saying is we never saw Darth Vader turn into a dragon.
No, we did not. Man, he turned into a good guy at the end.
He turned into an old white man, not a dragon.
An old white man who might need to collect some Social Security disability or something. I don't know.
And then they turned the ghost into Hayden Christensen.
You know, Medicare paid for all that breathing equipment. Well, great list, Joel. Your list. You know, good job as always sorting through your choices and justifying them as always. And very good.
Oh, same here, man. I mean, I think we actually make good cases for villains that, you know, especially in the case of Maleficent or T-1000 or Zod, like, people know, but, you know, I think it's just kind of kind of taken for granted how interesting or how new they were for what they were doing.
Exactly. And like,
it's something we, it's hard because they inspire so many tropes. Like, it's hard sometimes, it's hard to keep in mind how interesting and singular they were before all those imitators came.
Yeah. And I always like to the opportunity to breathe some life into these characters and, like, you know, have people check them out under maybe look at them from a different angle, as we covered here. So especially in terms of, you know, Dolph Lundgren from Universal Soldier. I mean, people will probably tend to forget about that movie, as well as that character in general, more so. And just, you know, watch some of these movies and check out these characters from a different angle and get some more perspective on it. With that said, Joel, you know what time it is?
Oh, I do. It's time to stump Joel.
It's time to stump Joel. I wish I had some theme music for that. I might create some theme music for it, Joel, about that.
Oh, I'm into that. We really, really
It'll be maybe some like 60s or 70s style game show type music. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we can just take like a keyboard riff from The Doors. It sounds basically the same.
So the idea here is I've come up with five trivia questions about movies that Joel, hopefully Joel has seen them. I know I'm pretty sure he's seen all of these. I've given him a category beforehand. It is, since we're talking sci-fi, I went with 1980s sci-fi. We did 90s horror last time, so I've gone back in time, and I've switched the genres up. And let's hope that, the hope is we can stump him, because that's the whole name of the game here, is Stump Joel. And if I can stump him successfully, I win. And,
What do you win?
Another show with you, Joel. Another episode of Go Home in the Box.
So is that, and I win another show. We really need to put some, like, stakes up for this, man.
Yeah. All right. Well, how about I put some stakes up? How about a T-bone?
Actually, I wasn't expecting that literally, but yeah, make me a steak, dude.
I'll fix it for you and everything, man. Okay, so let's get to it. So 80s sci-fi is the category, Joel, okay? And I think I'll throw a softball at you to start. So question number one. In Aliens, what is Newt's real name?
Oh.
Because, you know, she wasn't born with the name Newt. Nobody would name their kid Newt.
Why that? I would name my kid Newt.
Well, I mean, it would be short for, like, Newton or something like that, but, you know.
I want to say it was something really, unfortunately, normal. Rebecca?
That is correct. I'll give it to
you. Yes.
Her last name... Oh, hey, her last name was Jordan.
Hey! Is she a descendant of yours?
Considering that... What do we call it when they're a future? Are they an ascendant? I don't know. Maybe so. That could be my future great, 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 grand, great niece. I don't know. Yeah, I don't. My family tree is kind of stunted, so I'll probably stop there.
Well, in that case, I am very sorry about what happened to her parents and brother.
Those jerks, they deserved every bit of it anyway. Question number two. And we're going to talk Blade Runner here. In Blade Runner, the Tyrell Corporation has a motto. What is that motto?
I'm going to have to just, like, give this one a pass because my Blade Runner knowledge is, like, nil. I mean, it's... Unless it's like tastes great, less filling, I do not know.
It does not taste great, less filling. So we've stumped you on this one, Joel.
We have.
It is more human than human, which is also a White Zombie song.
I was gonna say, like, that's where I know that phrase from. Of course, we know that
Rob Zombie, where his movie taste lies. So I'm quite sure that that song was inspired by the movie Blade Runner.
Oh, I have no doubt. He usually writes songs about much older film. Well, I guess a lot of 70s stuff.
Yeah, he's a huge Grimes fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, question number three. This is Back to the Future we're going to talk here. No, in Back to the Future, after Marty McFly successfully returns to 1985, his father, George McFly, celebrates the publication of his first novel. What was the name of the novel? Mm. Insert Jeopardy theme here.
I feel like we're going to get sued for that. All right.
No pressure.
It was something.
Do you remember the cover of the novel by any chance?
I feel like it was something like sci-fi romance.
Yeah. Do you remember when in 1955 when Marty showed up in George's bedroom in disguise? And he called himself Darth Vader.
Darth Vader from the planet
Vulcan?
Yeah,
he was wearing his, like, hazmat suit or whatever it was.
A match made in space, I want to say.
That is correct. Ding, 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 ding. Yeah, it is a match made in space. And the cover of his novel was Marty McFly in his hazmat suit.
Yeah.
Nice touch there. All right.
They should have called it Spaceman from Pluto after the title they the studio tried to force on Back to the Future. did you ever hear about that story?
I did not hear about that story.
The studio wanted to title it Spaceman from Pluto, like literally title the movie this, and they. Like, Spielberg and Zemeckis sent a memo back, like, faxed them a memo saying, great joke, we really had a laugh over it. And then the studio was too embarrassed to say it was what they were really suggesting.
Yeah, you know, that's it's quite funny. It would kind of, I don't know, if you're a fan of, like, 50s sci-fi, I can see where you could pull that from. But, of course, that had nothing to do with the content of the film.
I think they were probably going for, like, Marty's first appearance, like, in the hazmat suit.
Yeah, okay.
Which is what... But, you know, it's not even what he calls himself when he gets up there.
All right, well, question number four. Predator. In Predator, Dutch and his team are led to believe by Dylan that their mission in the jungle is to... What? And of course, remember, Dylan swerved them, but he told them that this was their mission.
I mean, it was to rescue hostages. Are we going more specific than that? Or,
well, yeah, I can give that to you, because it was actually to save a cabinet minister who was being held hostage.
Oh, specifically. You see, I didn't remember that.
Yeah. And so we'll give that one to you, because, you know, basically, you know, it's a hostage situation, so... And, of course, Dylan swerves them, and, you know, Carl Weathers becomes a big asshole.
Carl.
Quarrel. And our last question, Joel. Question number five. Are you a fan of Life Force?
Why, yes, I am.
Okay, this is a Life Force question for you, okay? To close it up. So, in the movie Life Force, Steve Railsback's characters, of course... Carlson. He doesn't have a first name. He's just Carlson. Even Matilda May calls him Carlson throughout the movie. Doesn't call him by his first name, even though she claims to love him. In what location does Carlson's escape pod land? So we have the space girl and her two brothers or whatever the hell they are. They find them first.
Wasn't that in your home state? Wasn't that or no, current state? Wasn't that in Texas? When his
that is Texas. Landed? That is the correct answer, sir. His escape pod lands in Texas, of all places, and it probably explains the huge hole in my backyard right now.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. Huge chunk of land if it's not landing in the ocean.
Well, I mean, Texas is hard to miss.
Yeah.
Because it's like 3,000 miles wide.
I mean, it'd be a lot more impressive if he managed to set it down in like Rhode Island, but
Texas
seems like a good place to land your pod.
Yeah, that's kind of like some precise landing right there. Landing in Texas is easy, man. That's nothing. I can land something in Texas.
Oh my god! You know, I was. When you said 80s sci-fi, you just about killed me, man, because I was reading up on my Battle Beyond the Stars, and, like, all that knowledge went to waste.
I couldn't come up with any Battle Beyond the Stars questions.
James Cameron worked on it. Other
than, what is that thing on Richard Thomas's face?
Richard Thomas was a wonderful man. You leave him alone. Seriously, he's like the... Let me tell you about Richard Thomas. He is like the nicest guy ever, and while talking to him, someone literally walked by and said, "Good night, John Boy Adam," and he did not kill that man.
Oh, man, I would have.
That must happen to him like a dozen times a day.
Of course, I'm a lesser man than Richard Thomas.
We all are.
Richard Thomas is a god among men.
Like I read up on my Galaxy of Terror and my Battle Beyond the Stars and my Space Raiders, all the ways, bro.
Oh man,
all the ways.
Well, you 4 out of 5 ain't bad. As well, the Meatloaf song isn't exactly like that, but you know, not bad.
You know, your Blade Runner fixation. Now I'm gonna have to go back and watch it again.
All right. Well, that's it. That's a good show for us this week, Joel. So some great lists and some great fun with the trivia. And appreciate your time as always. And so that concludes another show. And thank you for your time, Joel. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, man.
Yeah. And until next week.
Bad boys, what you want? What you gonna do? Yeah. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? When you were 8 and you had bad traits, you go to school and learn the golden rule. So why are you acting like a bloody fool? If you get hot, then you must get cool. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? You chuck it on that one, you chuck it on this one. You chuck it on your mother and you chuck it on your father. You chuck it on your brother and you chuck it on your sister. You chuck it on that one and you chuck it on me. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? What you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Nobody now give me no break. Police now give you no break. That old soldier man now give you no break. Not even your eyes you now give you no breaks. Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? With the love of a father, reflection comes and reflection goes. I
know sometimes you wanna let go. You chuck it on your sister. You chuck it.